Welcome, everybody. Delighted to have Jay Martin of The Jay Martin Show. Jay's actually done a great job of his YouTube channel, has had a lot of amazing guests on, and he's positioned very, very interestingly in that lovely, meaty, golden theme that we so love, the super macro cycle in the commodities area. So we're going to be touching on that. Jay, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here, Francis. Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Why don't we just kick off right in the middle of what I think is going to be a massive feeder for the commodities side. There's a lot gone on in the debt space. What's your take on debt and how that ends up in a trickle down for the great inflation trade and commodities?
Well, yeah, there's a few different directions you could go there. I think I've got some grave concerns right now just in the consumer debt sector, Francis. And, you know, the metrics that I watch there are just delinquent mortgages, delinquent credit card payments, delinquent auto loan payments. And an important one that is tracked less often is new credit application rejections, which is skyrocketed towards an all-time high. And so, you know, it paints you a picture, right? That people are unable to afford their monthly expenses. They're reaching for the credit they used to be able to reach for, but that credit's now being denied. And that's a paradigm shift. You know, when you think about the last 8-9 years of how that functioned, even in the last 2 years, I don't know how many credit card companies reached out to me making offers. Like I absolutely lost count, but they were landing in my door or in my inbox with regularity, right? I mean, it was, you couldn't push enough debt opportunities on people. Well, that's come home to roost now, you know? Yeah. And I'm up in Canada. My family's dual citizens, so we're American Canadian, but presently we're domiciled in Canada for the time being. And something like 70% of new mortgages in the year 2022 were variable rate. And those are all being repriced right now. A lot of homeowners are about to get whacked. And I'm seeing it across the board. I mean, we're often, you know, we'll be making the move back down south probably inside of 24 months. And, you know, a couple locations that are interesting, one of which is Austin. And, you know, Austin's been a crazy hot market, right? We were looking there 4 years ago and then 3 years ago. And it was just depressing because we're looking at the same house for $500,000 more and all this stuff. But now everything's been stripped. You know, we're seeing, you know, $100,000 cut downs, $250,000 cut downs, you know, on like, you know, not luxurious, but like modest single family homes, right? Those are huge cut downs on like a 4-bedroom house, you know? So puts it in perspective. People often ask, you know, are we headed towards a recession? And when you think through those numbers, it's such a ridiculous question to ask, isn't it? It's like, well, what are you waiting for? Like affirmation from CNN to tell you? You know,
I got given a number just to jump in on your stats, because I love the fact that you've got your stats close to hand to bomb it. There's over $1 trillion in credit card debt on an average interest rate of 21%. And that's, you know, the fallback revolving credit, you know, plan that's always there until it isn't, of course, until the cards are full and until those payments are being missed. And that's a horrible rate of usury extraction, 21%. And that's a big number, $1 trillion. Just to add to the subprime autos and everything else you were touching base on as well. Just another one, by the way, zero hit. Sorry, I'm helping you make your case. Apparently, the search phrase, hand back my car, give back my car, has been at its all new time highs. And there's the guy that speaks in this, the car dealer guy is his name. And he says, guys, you need to understand, you can't just bring your car back. We're talking about a repossession. You know, that is a formal debt surrender. It's you know, there's a lot of connotations that go with that. So it's ironic that also comes up as you're talking about the consumer retail aspect of debt.
That's fascinating. Hand back my car. I hadn't heard of that. It makes sense. You know, you're just overwhelmed by your payments. You're delinquent by, you know, 3 or 4 months, and you just try to drive it back to the dealership and leave it there. Interesting. I mean, you know, so exactly, right? When people debate whether or not we're heading towards a hard landing, soft landing, I don't know what you need to see right now. We set a record for corporate bankruptcies in the United States in August, right? You ask those employers or those employees if we're in a recession. Yeah. And the whole like hard landing, soft landing thing. Yeah, there's always a soft landing. It happens right before the hard one, right? Like, right? there's a moment, right? Right before you get punched in the face when it doesn't hurt at all, right? That's the soft landing.
And what amazes me is that the millionaire treasury secretaries like Yellen and all of these keep talking about what a wallowy, marshmallowy soft landing it is. And they keep running the front, running the narrative to try control that, so that anybody who thinks, man, it feels really tough out there is thinking it must just be me. You know, I'm my industry or my particular, well, I'm not pitching myself well right now. So it's almost like a gaslighting as well that's going on through the official government and corporate structures. We saw tech coming off. Ironically, on the debt side, I was not only referring to the retail consumer debt, I was just still referring to the rates that is actually happening, obviously, on the bonds. And we have at the same level on the consumer, we have the government's debt is being run in a similar way. Their interest payments now exceed that spent on defense. And we know the states is the biggest spend on defense compared to the next 10. And on top of that, we have the facts that Yellen actually, when the rates were super low, instead of getting out all the new debt that they were needed because of this deficit expending, we spend way more than we get in tax revenue on long-term debt when it was cheap and low. She did a lot of it on 2 years. Short-end debt. So it's kind of you refinancing everything you needed to roll over and refinancing, and you get a super cheap rate right now. And instead of getting it kicked down the can for a number of decades, you actually got it coming back at you in 2 years, only this time now it's going to come back at you with the current interest rate cycle. So what you were just describing at the retail level also 100% applies to the government and the treasury finances, and they're going to have to monetize. And this is what I was referring to as almost being the feeder stone. When they monetize and they're having to issue more and more debt, tax receipts dropping as expenditures are going. And of course, we've got a boondoggle for Taiwan, Israel, and Ukraine war refunding. We always seem to have money for that, which is basically money laundering. It's crazy not to see bonds markets absolutely having turned and going into a further collapse in value, which means further rate hikes. That's what people don't realize. Rate hikes is how you devalue debt. So it's kind of, as for us, so it is for government, only worse in a sense. Do you have a take on that?
Well, you know, it's the exact same principle. You're right. And it's nice to understand it at a consumer level because we tend to overcomplicate things at a government level, but it's the exact same predicament. And so, you know, think about some of those concepts: access to new debt application being rejected at record rates. This is sort of the treasury market right now. We're sitting on oversupply. There's not enough buyers for the treasuries that we need to sell. Okay, can't get access to new credit. Me personally, what can I cut within my household budget? How can I make the monthly budget work? Well, what are you going to do at the Fed level? You're going to cut military spending? Like, not a chance right now, not a chance. If you think, I mean, whatever percent of America supported financing Ukraine's war against Russia, that number is going to be 10x in favor of financing Israel. It's just, it's guaranteed. And I'm not taking a stance on any of that. I'm just, this is pragmatic math. That's what's going to happen. And, you know, it's the second sort of front page hot war we're dealing with in the last couple of years. But this is a long-term trend that's been bubbling under the surface between sort of, you know, the few major powers, whether it's, you know, Russia, China, and Iran, and then, you know, the West, or however you want to determine this. But, you know, these hot wars are the manifestation of hot wars and in cold places that have been occurring over the last 4 or 5 years. This is like high-speed underwater deep sea internet lines been cut. Everybody talked about the Nord Stream. Obviously, that one made major headlines, but these battles in, you know, deep sea and, by the way, deep space, which I understand is a very hard thing for people to wrap their mind around. But, you know, due to the amazing work of individuals like Dr. Harald Malmgren or Dr. Pippa Malmgren, you know, she's documented a lot of the space wars that have been occurring over the last 5 years where, you know, Russia's blowing up their own satellites with the intention to disrupt orbits by filling them with debris, making them inaccessible to American satellites. And when you compromise satellite territory, you compromise imaging of the world, right? Every image we've seen of, you know, Gaza or of Russia, Ukraine has come from satellite imagery, not to mention Uber Eats and everything in the middle. And so when you disrupt, you know, satellite technology by cutting deep water undersea cables or actually disrupting orbits, these are battles that have been occurring for 5-6 years. And now they're bubbling into the hot war stage of conflict, right? We've gone through, you know, the trade wars, economic wars, currency wars. Now we're in the hot wars. This is, it's
that
a lot.
Applies also, Jay, if I can jump in while you grab a breath, is it applies also to the financial side, because China has been distributing treasuries out now to a rapid degree, and the buyers have actually been Japan and the United Kingdom. And those are allies of the same. So they are, you know, the designated bag holder. We did a very interesting interview with Professor Werner of Princes of the Yen, and he'll tell you that the Fed runs the Bank of Japan. You know, they came to them and said, when they had a trade deficit too big with Japan, they said, you have a savings problem. We're coming to help you cure that. And that's when we got the hyper leverage of the Japanese 80s that led to the situation they find themselves in today. So it's fascinating that too. So you're getting the financial war, you're getting some of those soft war positioning that you were referring to in space and under the sea. And now we're getting the real hot wars, and there's always got to be money found for those. So this all leads to a proliferation of debt. And the problem with that is they've got to devalue that debt. That means it points to an interest rate spike to me. As much as people think that we're going to have a pivot, everybody was waiting for the pivot. The whole theme that when we first started a tightening cycle was the pivot, the pivot, the pivot, and then we go back to risk on. And everybody just wants the big long of the big risk on. And what they don't seem to understand is that this amount of debt coming to market at such a rate and the degree that it's going to have to be monetized, you're going to have to be paying much, much higher. It's no longer the search for yield. It's the capital preservation. It's the return of capital rather than the return on capital that seems to be coming on. And that plays on gold, which is tapping at the 2000 level, which brings us starting to get to your core theme of commodities. Incidentally, saw a chart of orange juice, highest ever, traded at $400. And I mentioned it, but no inflation. And someone said, well, there's a bit of a fungus out there as well. There's always a triggering event that helps push it. But we've done the same with cacao. We've done the same with live cattle. We've done all these different individual markets. So tell us how you see this feeding in. And let's not steal too much of your thunder on the big macro in terms of the commodity side.
No, you're on the money. And you're right. The live cattle futures chart is like the hottest chart in the world over the last 2-3 years. And, you know, when a commodity super cycle occurs, you're right, it happens in buckets and stages. And certain commodities catch that rally. They rally in price. Inevitably, they eventually become overbought because there's two things happening during a super cycle, right? You've got the big picture macro trends driving long-term supply and demand, but then you've got the trader activity and they jump in on those rallies and they overbuy things, you know, run the price up a bit further than the market needs it so that it pulls back and people think the bull market's over, but it's just the near-term volatility inside of the long-term trend. And because you have those two players, the long-term value and the short-term traders, you always see, you know, up, pull back, up, pull back, up, pull back. I mean, that's what happens,
yeah.
Right?
Beautifully described, by the way. Beautifully described, yeah.
There's many people
get lost for the trees and don't see the full forest as well inherent in terms of what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, if you're able to identify, and this is like the most important thing, isn't it, Francis, what kind of investor you are, then it helps you interpret all of that because, like, I'm a long-term value. Remembering that is super, super important when you see those near-term pullbacks, right? Because you can begin to question your conviction. What did I miss? Oh, I'm down 15-20% in this position. Like, you know, and then you got to step back and say, I'm not trying to predict what the world's going to look like this quarter or next. I'm trying to make some assumptions about how the world will function within 10 years, you know? And that's actually an easier game to play.
Much.
Predicting the big picture is a lot easier than predicting the short-term volatility. There's way more unknown and uncontrollable variables like, you know, the fungus on the orange juice, right? Like things like this can occur outside of our control, but the big picture trends are largely in play and somewhat unmovable. Now, there's, you know, a bit more to that, but,
absolutely.
You know.
Yeah. There's been such suppression on softs that there's always a triggering story within each industry. That's going to be the reason why it broke out that particular day, that week, that month. But overall, what you've actually looked at, of all the efficiencies that have come out of farming, animal husbandry, and all of these industries, what has actually happened is all those were scooped up by the supermarket chains. And these guys have lived on subsistence, highly commoditized, only scale, mega tech efficient plants, and they've still only got very normalized and sometimes below normalized profits. such to the point, the extent that farming's almost been an unpopular career choice. You know, farmers' sons, farmers have told their sons, go be investment bankers, my son, you know, almost, not quite, but almost,
yeah.
You know, you do something else. So what's actually happening now is we need some true margin to start falling back to the originators, rather than these oligopolies that have embedded themselves in the supply chain between the end consumer and the producer, because the producers haven't been getting wealthy and they've been scaling up, they've been adding efficiencies, they've been doing an unbelievable job. And all of that extra margin has just been taken off them by the scale purchasers that have had disproportionate oligopoly type power. And now I think that just has to be a wholesale margin climb for all the softs. And it's out of force of necessity, because now their fuels, their diesels are going up, everything. It has to move just to remain a viable business in any sense. And as I say, you'll get a narrative with each industry, but each one will pop in its own time. And you need to view it all as part of the larger price-based inflationary aspect, which has come with all this debt and all this proliferation and all this financial engineering of every other industry, except possibly farming itself. And that's trying to give a general narrative. Do you concur? Is there anything you'd add on that?
Yeah. So your comment about like, where is the appreciation for the producer really resonates, right? Because, and again, it's like the last 15 years, we've pushed all high performing professionals into two kind of useless careers, right? One being investment banking, the other being consultants. I mean, we've got an abundance of bankers and consultants right now, and there hasn't been a lot of appreciation and respect for the producers of the raw materials, whether soft or hard. The reason I think you're right that that's going to change is because we're seeing a return to value right now when it comes to those raw materials. And that's occurring, from my perspective, Francis, because my whole life thus far has been the era of increased globalization, right? That means more access to a wider variety of cheaper and cheaper goods, because there was trust enough in the global marketplace that if you wanted to buy whatever, and you have the cash or the credit, you could do so from whoever you wanted to. That's what the era of global trust, fragile as it might have been, it existed enough for us to accomplish rapid globalization and operate as one global marketplace. So the supply of everything was available to you if you have the cash or credit to afford it. But that game is over now. I firmly believe that era of globalization has come to an end. What's going to happen next? I don't think it's going to be simple, predictable, or quick. But it is the next stage. We are going through a big tectonic shift. And on the heels of that, I think the global sharing is over. We're seeing this. New battle lines are being drawn geopolitically in response to economic wars, trade wars, and now hot wars. And we're seeing different commodities be priced differently for between different alliances, right? Russia will be selling natural gas to China at 50% the cost they're selling to Europe this winter. And all this means is that the supply of the raw materials used to have or believe were guaranteed are no longer guaranteed. And countries that are influential in the export of these raw materials are going to realize the power they have. And they're going to start playing that hand. Like, look at a country like Indonesia, right? They're the world's largest exporter of nickel. And last year, they put a full ban on raw nickel export. Now, they're still exporting nickel, but they decided to own more of the supply chain. So now they're processing it in country and then exporting the processed material, right? At a massively increased margin, their nickel revenue has gone up like 30x since this decision. But their gain is somebody else's expense, right? And so, you know, China, Europe, United States, like many countries have approached the WTO and said, we can't allow Indonesia to do this, but this is the hand they've got, where they're going to play it, right? They understand that the supply of all raw materials is suddenly uncertain. And when something's uncertain, it goes up in value, right? So that's what we're experiencing now. By the way, Indo is doing the same with copper and cobalt moving forward. And we're going to see more of this spread around, where countries that understand, now's the time to play your power hand. Like, if you've been sitting on that, now's the time, because we're going through that shakeup right now. And, you know, evidence of this shakeup, you know, one data point that I like to look at, Francis, is the UN vote on whether or not to condemn the war in Russia, right? And, you know, it happened in 22, it happened in 23, and usually ends up like 141 countries vote to condemn and 31 either abstain or vote not to condemn Russia. And you could say, oh, that's a vote whether or not to, you know, condemn this war. But I believe what it really is countries pledging their allegiance to the West or the East. I mean, it's a proxy vote or that new geopolitical division. And you got 141 countries that are still saying, okay, we're going to stick with the West for now. But you got 31, and of those 31, like, if I'm correct, it was in the high 20s that just abstained, and a few voted not to condemn. But those abstaining countries were significant. It's like Brazil and Saudi Arabia. And they're just saying, we're not ready to call it yet. We don't know who we want to put our hat in with. We're going to let you wine and dine us for a little while here, right? We'll wait for a better deal. Who's going to make us the best deal? And they'll probably play both sides for as long as they can. And, you know, that's the era we're in.
Smart thing to do, to be honest. Negotiate, exactly, and get the best deal.
100%. 100%. Your country like Indonesia, absolutely. Now's your time. Now, it's a fine line, right? Because we've gone to war for some pretty silly things over the years. You know, I wrote an article a couple of months ago called The Banana Wars. I documented the Banana Wars. It was a series of wars at the end of the 18th, early 19th century, where the United States led invasions into Cuba, Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua. And tens of thousands of people died to protect the interest of the United Fruit Company. So it was the same thing. It was one country going to war, right, to gain access to another country's resources. Like, this is the oldest story in history. We did it for bananas. Would we do it for nickel? Of course we would. Yeah, like, I hope not. But, you know, I think we're entering that era where those conversations are on the table and where the precedent for hot war has been set. You know, the door's open now. And so we'll be less and less shocked by future conflicts as a consequence.
Yeah, it's great points you're making. In fact, it used to be almost a guaranteed curse to be resource rich, because you invariably got economic hitmen, if you know what I'm referring to in terms of Perkins's book. You know, you ended up getting a puppet government that got installed, had a proxy, you know, UN hand providing, they agreed to the following infrastructure products that Halliburton would do: build an airport, build some highways, and then they'd get the dollar injected debt, which was essentially enforcement for the petrodollar. And then they'd have puppet governments that would rotate every now and then, and they would largely be lackeys. And it's Africa, it's this tale of Africa, essentially. And that what you just described on Indonesia, being far enough away and independent enough to actually own more of the raw materials, later margin to come, and taking it closer to providing the steel that Japan needs for Toyotas and Mitsubishis, etc., and taking some of that margin back is very much a coming of age, maybe a unilateral rollback of some of the wealth to the nations that had been unduly treated. And I'm sitting talking to you from just under Table Mountain here in South Africa, and you know, because the Dutch East India Company that came and cornered the diamonds via the London and Dutch coffee shops in Kimberley, and then came for the gold as it, you know, in Johannesburg as that was found, and that was the Boer Wars, and that was everything. It was all about dominating those resources. Cecil John Rhodes, it was a fascinating study on that. And he died in Musenberg, literally about 30 Ks away from me, and then was shipped up to Zimbabwe. And he was an agent of the City of London who was funded by them and didn't want competition. These people never seek competition. To them, competition is sin. They wanted to own it all. He came with a bottomless check, and he bought all of the diamonds up. The famous negotiation with Barney Bonato, who was actually Isaac's, was all about securing the absolute monopoly so that price control existed and they could exert that and dominate a market. And getting some of this now back, as you described in the Indonesian example, who has great demographics, by the way. The other reason why Indonesia might be a great place to invest is, you know, that in terms of the youthfulness, they're at the right meaty part of the curve. They've got their peak taxpayer lump in the normal curve still to come. So it's a redrawing of the map. We speak of the Middle East and Singapore being a listing haven potentially for Indonesia, China, the acceptable face to all nations for future capital formation. We see that growing as well. How do you see the big structures? Because if you understand where the money's flowing from, where there's going to be less of capital formation and where there's going to be more, I sometimes talk about the tallest building being the vanity project of the future aspirant. You know, it was the Eiffel Tower at one point. It was in Britain at one point before that. Then it was the Empire State Building. Now we have the Burj Al Arab. We see how much money is going into the football there. That's what I call the dumb money and the vanity project. But behind that, I think there's more that's coming. What's your take on how the restructuring of the pieces and where the hotspots will be?
Yeah, so it's a hard question to answer, isn't it? You know, where might you go and how might these pieces fall? And so all I can speak to, Francis, is what I'm doing with my family, right? I've got three young boys. We've got a couple passports. That's helpful. But essentially, you know, I grew up in Canada. My wife grew up in the United States. So therefore, we both grew up in relatively safe, predictable, well-governed countries that provided us with tons of opportunity. I feel incredibly fortunate for that. How can I pay that forward to my kids? And will they find that same situation in Canada in 20 years, in 30 years when they're building their careers?
Good question.
Can't see that. I give it a confident yes. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, so right now we're building optionality. You know, we are building bases both north and south of the United States-Canada border, but we're also putting roots down in Indonesia. You know, we've spoken about Indo a couple of times here. I like what I'm seeing coming out of Indonesia. Yes, the demographics are super favorable. They're one of the few countries in the world that has really favorable demographics and somewhat predictable and safe governance. The nickel example, I mean, let's pull on that, right? They could have done a couple things there. They could have just nationalized some nickel properties. They could have imposed some super taxes. They didn't, though. They just expanded their industry, right? So they didn't penalize anybody for doing business in Indonesia. They just further built out their own supply chain. It was a very intelligent move because it increases their revenue, their federal revenue. But it doesn't necessarily scare investment away from the country, which is what typically happens, right? When you see nationalization or super taxation, et cetera. In addition, they're creating all kinds of incentives for affluent expats to arrive in Indo. And, you know, their visa, you can expedite the visa process by having, it's like 150 or 250 grand in a bank account or invested into Indonesian business. So it's accessible, but not to everybody. And all that says is that they're attracting professionals, ambitious individuals who are looking to build industry and continue to build out the country, right? So I do like that immigration strategy because it's very thoughtful. Whereas you look up in Canada, we've let in something like, you know, a million immigrants over the last 20 months. And I'm pro-immigration. Like I'm pro freedom of movement, right? It's never going to stop. It's always been how we migrate around the world. It always will be. But lacking quality, lacking the policies is just, you relinquish control in a situation where you don't have to, you know, Canada is a very attractive place to move. I mean, everybody wants to move here. So, you know, you could apply some strategy there, but we chose not to at our federal level. So, you know, and on a country whose whole population is 40 million, like another million people is colossal. That's a really big shift, you know, and obviously in the United States, they're facing their own, I'd call it like a super crisis at this point. And again, it's kind of like no holds barred, you know, reckless additions to the population. Indo's not doing that, right? So, you know, I like our roots in Canada because I like Canada's odds. I think with the right leadership, this country could really come out on top. You think about the 2008 financial crisis. Canada came through that with a healthier balance sheet than any other G8 nation because we had a federal leader who understood how to leverage our natural resource economy. We don't have that leader today, so we're in a much different situation. You know, the leader in 2008 told the public he was going to run a deficit, but it will be temporary, and he kept it temporary. He told the population he was going to run stimulus, but keep it temporary. He kept the temporary. I mean, these are like unheard promises these days, right? But, you know, that could come back. We could see return to common sense in the Canadian federal leadership. If so, Canada is a breadbasket of resources that the entire world needs. So in a prolonged commodity super cycle, I'm bullish Canada with the right leadership. You know, and I'll never count out the United States either. Like, you know, we can talk about where we may be in the inning in terms of like the cycle of empire, because there's a lot of, that we can just reflect on history that'll tell us we're in the late stages there. Having said that, it's still the strongest economy in the world. You know, the net asset value of the United States is more than just the federal balance sheet, right? It's the strength of the education system, the medical system, the entrepreneurship community, you know, the military. There's a lot there that kind of buffers the net asset value of the United States. And then, you know, for optionality, we're building roots in Southeast Asia. for the reasons that I already discussed, you know, because I don't know where the cards are going to fall, right? And when you don't know, what you want is optionality, right? And so we're building in this much optionality.
And when you have Canada and the US as your cards, which are very closely North American and tied, it's very wise to have something that's geolocated significantly differently, culturally, demographically. And I think that's a smart move. It really is. I encourage people to get Turkish, Mexican passports, and a variety of others that are considered the other side of the fence. Even South Africa sitting here with the BRICS situation, then they're less inclined to be pushed around by the Americans, although they've probably still got too much dollar debt somewhere. But it's still encouraging that geopolitically you've got to have a kind of a foot on both sides of the wall. It's almost like a Berlin Wall is being built again, unfortunately, and there's an East versus West again. And this time it isn't as clear cut about which one lives well and which one doesn't. So there could be some migration. And the problem with the States, not to undermine anything you said, I agree, actually, it's still a magnificent place for living standards. And I love meeting the American people, our followers. We're very well supported there. And generally, there's a great mindset of can-do spirit that you just don't have other places. But if the finances go, all those other things like the military and many other things, the welfare and the medicine, the cost of the medicine, a lot of that can suddenly crumble, unfortunately. Yep. So there is that risk factor. And if you have that happening in the States on your border in Canada, even if you know, you're doing well, selling your oil and doing various other things, it's also going to be a cataclysmic demand that's suddenly disappearing that was very, very significant for the average Canadian business as well. So there will be very big collateral damage there, less so than in Indonesia, which will be insulated by its neighbors and its domestic trade, which is more local.
Yeah. And, you know, the nature of the business that I run, if located in Indonesia, provides us with a lot of sovereignty. And that's the key, isn't it? Right. Like whether we're in Canada, the United States, Indonesia, Thailand, you know, what we're seeking is personal sovereignty and some insulation against the poor or reckless decision-making of others, right? Yeah. And so you got to build your whole life that way, not just where you're geographically located, but your business, if you can, definitely your investment portfolio, subtract and delete any counterparty risk that you can. That's all we're seeking, right? In terms of where we might locate the family. And I agree with you, by the way. I'm very concerned about the near-term future of the United States. I think it's too early to call, but you know, if you reflect on like the last 600 years, we've seen the rise and fall of the Portuguese Empire with the reserve currency. It was sort of a maritime currency, but it was widely accepted in the Spanish Empire, the Dutch Empire, the British Empire, now the American Empire. And that's five inside of 600 years. So it gives you a bit of a hint, the expeditious nature with which power rotates around the globe. And when you study those empires, you see the same stages, right? It's like they all go through the exact same cycles. You know, they're sort of poor. They became hyper-productive, built wealth, they became accustomed to wealth. That fueled decadence, decadence fueled debt, and debt fueled decline. So in that cycle, you tell me where the Americans are, right? And in those declining insolvent years, you know, typically you see a massive spread of the wealth gap. Does that exist? In response to that, you see crazy expressions of civil unrest that border on anarchy and civil war. Are we seeing that? Maybe. And the third is like an external competitor, right? Is there somebody else in the globe who can challenge that superpower? And generally it's not one country. It's like a collection of smaller nations, exactly, who can pause their ideological differences and align with the purpose to unseat the global superpower. Are we seeing that? Like you tell me, right?
Yeah. The thing I'd like to add to that is when you want to crash a plane, the leadership you bring in is the people that don't fly planes well. And if I look at kamikaze pilots, and if I look at the leadership in Canada and America, and I hold up Trudeau and Biden, you get the man for the job. The question is, when you get such levels of clearly non-economic incompetence, what is the job? The job is destruction. That's the only conclusion I can come to. And that's what worries me immensely, because you get this overweighted priority on wokeism and political correctness and language and making sure biological men can compete in female competitions because they identify a certain way, and all of this nincompoopery, and you actually stop having principle. what you see is the dearth of genuine principle. Do you live by principle? Is there a system of integrity? You know, you get art that's being bought for ridiculous prices. It's quite clearly a money laundering racket. I'm talking about the Ukraine flag one that was literally a blue stripe on a yellow stripe, a massive canvas thereof. This sort of thing, and the speech money for the Clinton family, you know, whether it's Hillary or Bill and all of this. This is obviously recycling money, tricks for favors and all of this. And it gets so overt that it goes beyond that they're not even pretending anymore. So in other words, I don't even want to have to pretend that I'm a crook and a criminal, Jay, and that I'm stealing your stuff and I'm selling it on the black market. I'm not doing it in front of you, and what the hell you're going to do about it? Maybe I should, you know, I can get so cocky and you're going to be so back off you, I'll just take over your property and move in and tell you to, you know, bugger off. That's how, unfortunately, it feels. The complete void of integrity and the kamikaze pilots coming in, taking over the 747's control. And that leadership for me, I think, and the fact that they got in and the manner and whether they got in, or, you know, there's lots of foxholes I don't think we need to care to bother with right now. But there's just no confidence. There's no system confidence. There's no integrity, and there's no principle anymore. Sound money advocates, this is all a perversion, apparently, and everything else inverted is absolutely normal. And that's my concern. It's subversive. It's an overt subversiveness that is hell-bent on destruction. Unfortunately, you have to step aside for that, and you have to have a fallback. And you get the old ex-communist states that have done that thing and actually want to be pro-business, or wanting anybody who's got a quarter of a million or 150,000 in a bank account. They'll sit with some dollars in a bank. They'll give you, a right of residency. They'll encourage you in a business. And now you're getting people that are appreciating talent. And the good thing is stealing someone else's strapline, but always go where you're treated best. Go where the principles that you espouse are greatly aligned. And when the place that you are no longer reflects or manifests, this is my sort of rant, stroke, preach moment, I suppose. The minute you no longer feel aligned and the principles are not being upheld of integrity, then it's time to realign somewhere else. And sometimes that involves you, unfortunately, having to move to a place that is embracing those concepts rather than one that is used to have them and is burning them. And I don't know if you feel that same level of just cheating on the moral contract that we've all had.
Yeah, 100%. And it's a tough one to grapple with, isn't it? To depart from the country you're from because the values have just departed from where you stand. And I get a bit of flack sometimes, Francis, from subscribers or even just friends of mine when I talk about, you know, pulling chute and moving to Indonesia. And the response is typically something like, oh, you're going to give up on the country that's given you so much. And, you know, I get it. But okay, let's just dive into that a little bit, because I've been an entrepreneur in this country for 15, 17 years now. I've been employing citizens of Canada. I've been paying above average tax relative to our population. I've been contributing massively. So sorry, you know, take from the country and then run, or did I give a lot too, you know? And I really stuck it out. Like, I tried, you know, I've almost emancipated myself from my bricks and mortar company here to go full remote. We're like 90% invested in our remote business now, strictly to give ourselves that optionality. And when it comes to like the concept of, well, it's not a very patriotic thing to do to leave your country. It's like, well, I'm not very patriotic, to be honest with you, right? Like, I don't feel proud to be Canadian. Now, that's not to say I don't feel lucky. Those are different things, but I'm proud of things that I accomplished. I'm proud of the businesses that I've built. I'm proud of the races I run. I'm a competitive triathlete. Right? I'm proud of raising my kids when they do good things. You know, I'm proud of that stuff because I did the work and accomplished the thing that I'm now proud of. But I just feel lucky and fortunate to have been born where I was born and grew up where I grew up. And so my mission therefore is like, okay, well, how can I find that fortune for the next generation of my family tree? I mean, that's the big mission that I'm actually thinking through. And you know, I don't see strong leadership. It's really unfortunate, but you know, I'm quite close with, I've had the former Prime Minister of Canada on my podcast once, and he's come out to speak at one of my conferences in Vancouver. And we've had some great chats just about, you know, what's going on with the current establishment in Canada. And, you know, there's a handful of directions you could take that. But, you know, I want to, there's a lot of like sort of conspiracies that end up making headlines, like, oh, he's, you know, he's Fidel Castro's son or whatever. It's like, I really hesitate. I really ask people to pause in all of that, you know, and all the sort of wild conspiracies around Canadian leadership, because the cold hard truth is that it's just, it's hardcore incompetence. That's what we're dealing with, right? And we had this Nazi stand up in the Canadian Parliament to get a standing ovation. And there was all these threads online about, oh, the real narrative behind this and the intention. There was no intention. It was just incompetence. That's the scary thing. It's just real incompetence. We have very incompetent leadership right now. I mean, I've hired the former Prime Minister of Canada. When you have those individuals in a room, you need to know everybody in that room. You got to have them on a list and know a little bit about their background. Their security, you have to complete. The standing Prime Minister, it's 10x. There's no way that anybody in that room hadn't been run through a thorough background check. It was just incompetence. It was overlooked, right? Just silly incompetence. And that's the truth, right? The scary truth, right? And so, yeah, deeply concerning. And frankly, it's very similar in the United States, right? I mean, you're sending, it's abuse of the elderly at this point, right? To send this man to go negotiate global trade deals with younger, energetic, aggressive, you know, manipulative, strategic world leaders who are there in a cutthroat manner to look out for their own population. And who are we sending to the table, right? To negotiate our best interest. Do you have confidence in that? Like, would you send either Trudeau or Biden to go negotiate a business deal for you?
I don't think he's doing anything in truth, but he is the accepted face that many people believe is representing them, and that on its own is highly, highly damaging. And as I say, when you want everyone to realize the plane's going down, you put the kamikaze pilot on. You know, he comes with the headband with the little red sun, and he has his samurai sword ready to plunge in his belly as he grabs those controls. It's just not a good sign. You know, when you were talking about, there's a lot of sideshows, like you mentioned, the Castro element, and we can have fun with that, and, you know, Obama and all of this stuff. But you've just got to go back to base principles at the end of the day. That's also a little bit of a Kardashian show of distraction. You almost just have to go, principally, am I aligned? You know what you were referring to? I went through a similar set of circumstances. You know, I was born here in Southern Africa, and I loved it. And of course, I was born during the apartheid era. And then I was made to go to the military for 2 years, and, you know, we were fighting against the communists and, you know, in wherever, and we just went wherever the flow goes. And eventually I got to a point where, you know, people were saying, oh, you're going to go and run. And it's hard to leave your home. You know, you know everything else is new, culturally different. You have no friends, you have no schoolmates, you have no university pals. It's not an easy choice, but I was lucky that I was made to do that early because of that microcosm that existed. Because it made it very easy for me to visit, be comfortable in a place for a while, and then to be comfortable somewhere else. Once you've cut the umbilical cord with your primary home, it's always easier every other time. And then you can become cold, pretty ice-veined, and you can say, does this in place reflect values that I am acceptable to be at? Yes, it does, or to a certain degree. You can decide how much of a year you choose to spend there, and I spend, you know, three parts of three different years in the same year in different places. I want more summers out of my remaining years. I figure that if you double the amount of summers you get if you avoid winter. I don't do a huge amount of snow sports. I wouldn't mind 3 weeks of skiing or whatever, snowboarding, but I don't need 6 months of winter, especially with rain and sludge in the UK as it was at one point. So I said, why am I here? I just questioned everything. Once you've severed that umbilical cord, you question everything. Why am I here? Why am I living here? Why am I doing this kind of work? Why am I not? And eventually you end up doing the work you most love, living in the places and the climate you most enjoy for the best financial return without overfunding, tertiary extracting governments that are perpetuating a cycle of war and geopolitics, most of which you don't agree with. So you have to align yourself with your principles. And if the country, your loyalty is to yourself first and to your family, and to secure them a great life and existence. Countries will not die for you, but they'll certainly have you die for them. And you don't have to do it. You don't owe anybody that. And you have the rights and freedom of movement for now. You should use it. And there's a lot of people. The minute you choose to leave, you then have a marketplace that are competing for bright, energetic, capable people that want you. They've got some of their own that they were lucky they were born with. They tend to stay because of inertia. Everybody tends to stay out of inertia. change your slave master. If they are the extractor over you, change your slave master and get a better slave master. Go to a different country that gives you the climate you want and the terms and the financial conditions you want. And I just feel everything always comes back to that. And that's the great thing about an online business and wealth building through investment, long-term trading like you. We don't sit on nine screens and day trade. When you were mentioning it, by the way, I want to bring another point in, this bit of a sidebar. But one of the great things that you mentioned about being long-term is that that's invariably less leverage. I feel people's impatience and leverage sees them end up dropping into the smaller time frames and ending up getting lesser good outcomes on account of being sucked into the lower time frames. And one of the things we committed to discuss here is how do we help people be better with that wealth building? What's your comment on that as a potential error trap or pit?
It's like the most common error that investors make, isn't it? Is rushing into decisions because everybody wants to get rich today. I'll just say something. Getting rich is easy if you have patience and discipline. If you have patience and discipline, getting rich is easy. And yes, that means you're not going to be rich tomorrow. But if you can understand duration, be patient and be disciplined with your process, it's not a hard game. It's not. Because, compounding will take care of itself. So here's an example, right? Warren Buffett, everybody knows this name, most successful investor that any of us have ever heard of. The number one reason that he's worth what he's worth is duration. Had he run the exact same portfolio strategy that he ran, right? But he maybe began when he was 30 and invested until he was 65, like most people, he'd be worth less than 1% of his present net worth. But because Buffett's been an investor for over 80 years, that duration has made him the oracle of Omaha, right? I mean, he started in his early teens. He's still going in his 90s, right? So but having said that, had he begun when he was 30 and gone until he was 65, he still would have been rich. I mean, do the math, less than 1%, but he'd still be rich. He wouldn't be Warren Buffett rich, but that's long enough if you're patient and disciplined. 35 years, it's a good tenure as an investor, right? But most people don't have 100%. That. I mean, the best performing asset that most investors will ever own is their house. And that's not because real estate's always the best performing asset class. It's because it's the one asset that people hold for 25 years. Yeah. Duration wins, right? Again and again. Right.
Such a good point.
We don't want to be patient, right? Nobody wants to be patient. So what does that tell you? Well, if nobody wants to be patient, then how do you become the outlier and gain a competitive advantage? Patience. No one's doing it. That's right. That's the contrarian strategy. And it works because so few people do it, right? Everybody tries to outsmart the market and, ride the rallies and pick up on, headlines and buy stocks based on what their friends are buying and FOMO and meme stocks and all of this garbage. But just like, the market's not a get rich fast scheme. It's a go broke fast scheme or a get rich slow scheme. You get to choose that, right?
Yes.
there's a lot there, but we have there's a few things that I think are overlooked in the market. And number one is the duration, is the time horizon. But that's just to say, step one for everybody should be figure out what kind of investor you are. Are you a day trader? Are you a swing trader? Are you a long-term value investor? Are you a passive ETF investor? Are you looking for yield? All of this stuff. But the way you get to that is by having an honest conversation with yourself about how much time do you have to invest in being an investor? And not today or tomorrow, but over the course of years, because that's what forms a habit, right? You don't hit the gym today and get jacked tomorrow. It's got to become part of your lifestyle. Investing is just the same. Building a business is just the same. Maintaining a marriage is just the same.
Exactly. Micro habits. Yeah. It's what you compound. Yeah. It's always been about what you compound. Small little decisions compounded. There are no big secrets. There are just millions of tiny little micro habits that over time you compound. And your comment about duration is an excellent one, and you made it fantastically well. You are essentially a sum of the micro habits you compound over an extended duration. That is it. If you're overweight, it's because of small amounts. You actually have to make very small changes. I'm one of those lazy guys that chooses to do small things rather than big things, but to rather leverage them with time. And there's a book on micro habits. I think it was James Clear. I might be out of habit, but I recommend everybody read it. I literally studied it and wrote it up, and you should laminate your set of habits, even right down to really simple things like rinsing your mouth with peroxide in the morning, brushing your teeth with a little bit of bicarb so that your saliva is alkali. Tiny little things like that, that every day we've done, all do very small things that over time become, and you establish this as routine through all the way through. And it's incredibly powerful. And it's no different for investing. Just as an additional point on the Warren Buffett, the only problem most people will have is A, they're not going to get 80 years in the market. Many of them will be starting at our age or older. B, they're not going to get the same U.S. equity market. Where will that new market be? And one of my concerns, and I'm trying to give guidance for where, if you did 30 years of loyal, slow, and most people, by the way, on your other part of your point, most people that think they're day traders aren't going to be successful day traders. They all should be in the latter category. So if you have one of those guys that think, no, I'm snatching my 50 pips trading on 9 screens every day, all I have to do is that, that's how I'm going to earn it. You're going to do less well than the same human being doing the other strategy in most instances, almost universally. But that's a sidebar comment from me, just from having seen it all and tried it all. But anyway, the next place is where that's going to be. We need to position, where is the new America? Where is the America of the 60s going when that boom was first started that Buffett was heavily participated in, right the way through to the 20s that has seen him, you know, take the better part of 80 years. I think it might have been even in the 50s. And that's a little bit tougher. But even if you did it on the American market and you were astute, often the trackers, the things that are self-eliminating, outperform the active managers. So just get the best industries. And if you can get it, if you don't trust yourself and you take it from us that the grand commodity cycle, both in softs, foods, agris, energies, and I think in metals as well, substantially in ores and right the way through the industrial through to the precious, are going to do well. You could select 3 ETFs that could be global, and you could just dollar cost average into them and stack. And the thing about them is they self-eliminating. If a particular big corporation that was dominant starts to lose, you actually divest from that and you buy the new. So you are trend enforcing by nature of trackers. And that's one of the reasons why they've done rather well. So that notion, and different industry and markets, we've got a couple of fields through our Hunt Volatility Funnel method that we see certain geographies doing rather well. But I actually like the grand commodity cycle play with the great unwinding of the financialization of everything and the debt unwind. What else would you say, if Jay, you've got an audience here, you're in the wealth space, what else would you say? Because that, I mean, the duration point you made was outstanding. And you're talking about commodities. What else have you, as principles, would you like to highlight to somebody who's listening to this, who's hearing you for the first time? How would you counsel them?
Well, I may follow up that duration point by saying, how do you accomplish duration? And the reason that most people don't is because they get too aggressive, too quick, bet more than they can afford to lose on a decision they haven't researched thoroughly enough, and they get wiped out. Now, again, like, how did Warren Buffett stay an investor for 80 years? He never got wiped out. He stayed at the table, right? And so you need a strategy to keep yourself at the table. What's that?
Defense. In fact, I'm going to be a proper patriot South African. They just won the Rugby World Cup without scoring a try. But the one thing their whole game was built on was defense. I often say attacks win a match, but defenses win championships. And defense means your capital preservation, if I can help you make your point that I think you were already making very well, is that capital preservation is sacrosanct. It's not what you gain, it's what you don't lose. And by keeping it really, really tight, the staying in the game bit, you get the growth just by virtue of compounding and everything else. It's what you don't lose by doing anything. And the biggest killer that will give you those losses is getting, I'm good at this, let's accelerate it, let's add leverage. There's forks in the road that take you off the superhighway to wealth, and they wing you right down to Armageddon and back to go. It's like snakes and ladders. And the principle of trying to say, hey, man, I've had 3 really good years now. imagine if I just had two or three times the money. What if I were to just now do this? Because usually when that thought occurs, when you're at your most stroppy, your most bullshit, and that was the other thing about the Springboks, no ego. The coach pulled off star players and subbed them if they weren't playing, and then weren't allowed to throw a towel or have a strop, anything. It's the team is everything. The principle is everything. We're all doing this for each other, and you walk, and you're grateful for your time. You cannot have ego. You cannot start believing your own headlines, and you cannot bring the leverage. So that you've got to stay grounded. It's actually a psychological, it's a psyop. You've got to overcome a psyop of your own making, and it's often the good things that are designed to seduce you away from the original foundational principles. And it's kind of like the path of the founding fathers of America and where we've ended up today. You might ask, how did you get there? Because you got seduced. You got seduced by the financial investment bankers. You got suckered into lending. You got into consuming things that you hadn't yet earned the money for. You started pulling forward all of this. These are principal failures that I find that are endemic to the absolute rot that will bring down anything. And I'm interested in, I think you'll concur with that, certainly. What do you feel?
Yeah, I mean, at the core there, what you're saying is people start believing there's a shortcut and they try and take it, right? And very few things in life actually work that way, whether it's consumption of material goods or homes and cars and loans to pay for those things so you can have them today, you can take the shortcut, or it's the market, right? And you can catch that winner. You'll catch that one winner somehow, right? And take the fast track to massive wealth accumulation. But more frequently, what happens is you'll get wiped out. And that story will never be told, right? When somebody hits a five bagger or a 10 bagger, they tell everyone. And so, you know, that's what new investors see and they think it's possible, but no one talks about getting wiped out, getting 80% drawdown, et cetera. But, you know, yeah, that defensive play, that's it, you know? And I use a strategy called the barbell in my portfolio. And that's just to say, like, organize it how you want to, but you have wealth on opposite sides of the risk spectrum, right? And so over here, I'm investing, I'm looking for capital gains. I'm looking to create wealth. And over here, I'm preserving purchasing power. And those are two different functions. And so in my preserving purchasing power bucket, I want boring. I want assets that don't have any volatility. I want stable, safe haven. I want preservation of purchasing power. And so there is where you'll find, you know, wealth, liquidity, you'll find property, you'll find physical gold. Those are the things that I park there. And they all function a bit differently, right? Housing's got its own kind of volatility. Gold does as well. You know, the purchasing power on fiat currency obviously is very questionable, but it is liquidity, right? And so that's what's in that bucket. It's relative to a lot of assets. It's not very volatile. Over here, knowing I've got this side buffed out, like this is not at risk. This is good. My family's good, right? No matter what happens. I can be aggressive over here because if I make a poor decision, if I'm wrong on timing, you know, I've got the patience because I've got the stable side of the barbell buffed out. So I don't have to, you know, what this does for me is gives me confidence because even if I go through a really rough season, a bear market, a massive cut down or drawdown, I know I've still got my wealth protected in the unvolatile asset classes. Now, it does a couple of things. It keeps me at the table, right, in that worst case scenario, which allows me to participate in duration, but also it changes how I think, right? Because when you know you're going to be okay, like when you know you've got it in your back pocket, you know, you operate differently. When a market crashes, you see everybody panic. There's panic buying and panic selling. A lot of short-term decision-making. And that's occurring because people realize how exposed they are, how vulnerable they are, right? Now, if you've got the stability of a buffed out, stable side of your barbell, you don't have to be in a rush to do anything because you know you don't have to. So you can sit back and let the idiots panic buy and sell all day long. You can strike when you see a real opportunity because you preserve liquidity over here. Now, that's a long, patient game because that opportunity doesn't come every day. When it does, you want to be ready, you know? And that's like, it's the same as like, you know, I use this analogy, but, you know, when I was younger, friends, I used to get picked on a lot when I was like a little kid. I was a little guy. And it was quite bad, actually. I was sort of running around scared every day. And my mom put me in kickboxing classes. And I learned how to fight. And I never became an aggressive person. I never went looking for fights. But once I learned how to handle myself and I realized that most people, frankly, just don't, it changed how I interpreted the world and how I walked through it. And moving forward, if somebody got loud and got in my face and got aggressive, I had a new option in my back pocket. And that option was to just wait and do nothing and realize probably nothing's going to come of this. But either way, I don't have to react because I'm not scared of what might occur. Because if the worst case scenario occurs, I can probably handle it because I had that side of my barbell. In this case, it was physical confidence, but today in the market, it's the physical assets. But it's the same psychological impact, right? You don't want to be reactive when shit hits the fan. You want to be slow, thoughtful, methodical, strategic, right? And proactive with your decision-making. So, you know, that's its core and it's overlooked because it's boring. Nobody wants to build out the boring, slow money, right? But that's what keeps you at the table. That's what allows you to participate in duration.
100%. And that was beautifully spoken. And that's the key thing. The slow dough is better than the fast dough. And when we talk about anything that involves any form of leverage, the right to leverage has to be earned. And it's earned by a big layer of slow investment base, followed by a smaller, slightly more aggressive, but still unleveraged base. And once you've got a full, you know, pyramid structure, you can start talking about that sort of golden triangle that fits on top of the pyramid, which is your leverage, and you wait for the, and then you really have to have a sense of timing. And I think most people never have to get that far. Once you've got two or three of those other layers in and placed down in the ground, you're very well set. And I will say, even with the obscure and very bizarre global system that I see coming, that is going to be quite lockstep, quite anti-personal wealth and going very much lurching, particularly in the West, towards what I'd describe as a sort of technological oligopoly fascist communism generally. Even if you do those things right and you stay in the West, you still have a very decent chance of being able to afford all these extra new taxes that they're going to put on your homes and precious because you will have done other things well. So you don't have to leave your home. I suggest people should. You won't be pushing up against a machine that's hell-bent on the great leveling of the middle classes. But you'll still, if you do these aspects right, you can survive almost anywhere, to the point of, you know, physical revolution and armed, you know, confiscation, which I think is kind of on the fringes and a bit out there as a likely outcome. Not beyond possible, but nonetheless a bit out there. So yeah, these investment principles. What else would you share with the guys, Jay, that you like in terms of principles? Because I'm loving what I'm hearing here. This, you know, you made the point, let's just do a quick summary. The point on duration, the point on slow, low volatility is your friend. The slow dough is your friend, not the quick dough. And then you've also mentioned alignment of principle in your own phraseology of having multiple optionality. It's a phrase you've used quite a lot, you know, both in citizenship right of residency, multiple geographic jurisdictions, so that you don't have all those eggs in the other basket. What else would you add in there as your, you know, the Jay's five bullet point wealth building bit top tips?
Yeah. Okay. So in our five bullet points that we distribute, next up, we say build your team. You know, and what building your team means is that you've identified how much time you have to invest in being an investor, but what are you going to do with that team? And you need to seek out educators and personalities that you can learn from, right? So you're investing that time and becoming more intelligent with your decision making. Yes. And it's hypercritical with this that you seek out personalities who communicate in a way that resonates with you. You have to enjoy it or you're not going to go back. You know, like for example, when someone's asking me, like, how can I begin understanding the basic fundamentals of macro? I often push them towards my buddy George Gammon, because George is a lot of things, but one of them is funny. Like, he's just a funny guy. He's kind of a pleasure to learn from, right? And because he's entertaining, people go back. You know, they go back for more. And that allows the learning process to compound.
George is great, yeah. And he's a simple 3 points, whiteboard. He draws a picture. Many of us understand, you know, draw exactly. Me a picture. Exactly.
Yeah. So find those humans, build your team out, and make sure, this is very important, that you find personalities that disagree with each other. Right. So you want a Brent Johnson and a Luke Gromit, right, who do not see eye to eye on the future of the U.S. dollar. You want a Grant Williams and a Lynn Alden, right? So, like, you know, gold versus, you know, the Bitcoin concept. Right? You want to understand both sides of the coin, or else you just end up in an echo chamber. You let yourself, you're letting yourself there to be just laid out, right? And the other side of that, building your team out, is like, beware of the guru. And what I mean by this, there's a lot of commentators in finance whose real business is just selling you information, right? And it's, you know, a few things you should do to determine who's real and who's not. You always got to make sure they got skin in the game. Are they putting their cash where they're telling you to, or where they're saying is a good idea? Like, are they practicing what they preach? You can determine that by digging into these folks. And one sort of rule of thumb, I know this pisses people off, but I don't care. It's very important. If the personality's brand, podcast, the newsletter, the YouTube channel, whatever, is tied to a specific asset class, like, just maybe that should raise some questions, right? You know, the gold speculator, okay, they're in the business of selling you on the idea of how to allocate capital into the gold sector. So are they going to tell you that maybe gold set up to crash and be in a five-year bear market? Well, that's not very good for business, right? Yeah. Same thing in the crypto market. You see, like, you know, Bitcoin investor XYZ, whatever newsletter. It's like, so their business is selling investment advice into the crypto sector. Are they going to tell me that for the next 5 years, it's not a good time to be in crypto? They're not going to do that, right? Real estate, the same. And so, you know, beware of those gurus that marry an asset class and tie their whole brand and 100%. Business to it.
Yeah,
probably not going to get honest.
You know what's a great, if I can jump in on that, because you made another absolute humding of a point. We've almost gone so far as I teach all our guys in our community. We have four or five guys that will also do, in fact, more than that, sorry, that do our webinar updates so that people hear things not just from me. In other words, it must be principle-based. It's not personality-based. And the one thing I ask them to do is remove the word believe. Because belief is something that everybody accepts as given. It's like you believe in a God. That means there's no rational proof. And I'm not getting into atheism versus religion in this, but I'm just saying conceptually, you need a rational assessment that is on balance of probability something, rather than I believe gold is the thing. Once you've said, I believe gold is the only way that we get out of this, you have closed your mind, and that word belief is like a ring fence. And that it means everything in there. And even good people, not people that are just tied and doing it because they're talking their pocket and they, you know, they earn a commission on an affiliate, a gold link or something like that. The minute you do that, you can't see the possibility in a crypto. You can't even see the possibility in a status crypto, even if it is a status crypto. Not that I'm over pushing crypto, because you get the exact same thing. You actually get it more fervently in younger people that are of utter conviction. And they say, I believe this is the token. So you've got to really watch for the language that people use, because people tell you who they are. People generally tell you who they are. Listen to them speak, but listen to this. And so everything we try to do is, we've been of many things without being any one. You know, we can be long the dollar at the moment, and we could be... we could have been recently bullish Bitcoin, and we could have recently been bullish gold, but first we traded it short because we thought it would have a sell. You've got to have that almost ambidextrousness and that dispassionate calculating mindset that is not captured. And anybody whose sole income is determined by that industry is invariably captured agent.
You said it earlier. You're like, you know, you can die for your country, but your country is not going to die for you. It's the same thing. You can love that asset. That asset is not going to love you back. So when you 100%. See these folks get evangelical about their asset class, like I attribute it to like sports fans, right? When people start cheering on an asset class, like they're cheering on a sports team, and it's like, whoa, okay, all right, I'll see myself out. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Now you should put your money. Not at all. Not at all.
No, not exactly. And actually, the other thing is, I'll add, I don't know if you have this, because we're fleshing out your five bullet plan, and we've already got four amazing bullet points. But one thing I would say is, you actually have to become more circumspect about when things are going your way towards moving towards the door. The best traders are thinking of targets and takeoff points when the market is running. The crowd is asphyxiated with the chase of the momentum. Chasing of momentum is one of the greatest flaws. If you are in the current thing, you're probably a momentum chaser. If you're in the thing that's moving now, what we do, and I've kind of concluded this, I've studied this psychologically, Jay, and I'll share you my depth of observation on this, because I'm sure you'll appreciate it as a teacher and educator in that space, and you'll pass it on if you think it's worthwhile. But inherently, people are risk averse. So what they do is they wait till something starts to happen. They then think all the risk of it is removed because now it's a fact, where previously it was a possibility. And they go all in on it, continuing to happen as if the continuation of that happening is as assured as the fact that it started to happen, if you know what I mean.
Inherently,
the momentum is king. So these are people that get swayed by momentum. And any of the many scammy crypto projects that have been and gone, one of the things they always know is first get a bit of a group and an audience and a rah, 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 then create some momentum, and that will suck in a whole bunch of other people when everyone else starts bragging about the momentum of the move. And then it can blow off on that momentum, the insiders can exit, and you know, that whole thing can crash to zero. And the amount of times people will rinse, repeat, smart, intelligent people will chase the new thing on the basis of momentum. And if you know, I'm a technical trader. I put the technicals even before the fundamentals, but I'm fascinated and very fundamentally engaged. But I will, if something is fundamentally right, but it doesn't show yet in the chart, I won't touch it. But you've got to have a setup that is something that precedes the big move, not something that is the big move, because then you're a top chaser all the time. And I would say momentum chasing and the new thing, whether it's NVIDIA, now in a head and shoulders for us, could actually be a point where it starts to spill, but you'll get people late arriving. It was the same with the .com. How do you feel about that belief and then the momentum chasing? Two almost separate points, but both point to non-analysis and emotive responses.
Yeah, I think it's a departure from what the market is. I mean, people forget that when they're investing in an equity or buying something, that there's a seller who has a similar but opposite motive, right? And so when you buy shares in NVIDIA, you know, you're having a disagreement with somebody. You don't think about it that way, but investors should. You believe that that share is undervalued and going to go up. I mean, I hope that's why you're buying it. Yeah. You have to understand, on the other side of that transaction, there's somebody who's selling it because they believe it's overvalued and going to go down. Yeah. And so you have to ask yourself, what do I know that that person doesn't? I'm about to square off with somebody here. What's my competitive advantage, right? And if you can't answer that question, you are walking in blind. I mean, you're just betting on hype. I mean, that's it, right? And so, you know, I ask myself that question before I buy a share in anything. What do I know that the seller doesn't, or what's my competitive advantage, right? And I'll give you an example. It's not always as clear as you think, but right now, for example, I'm being quite aggressive in junior gold producers. So companies that are producing about 500,000 ounces per year with a path to 1 million, right? They're very undervalued. The market hates them. And I love it because they're cheap, and they're, you know, you can pick off the companies that have really sound management who have built and sold two or three companies, and they're on their fourth or fifth venture. Now, why am I able to buy shares in those companies? Well, I'm able to buy shares in those companies because that market was super hot in 2020 and momentum took over and hype took over investors, and they charged in 2021. Then the market corrected dramatically. And a lot of these companies are now down 80%. So, you know, 2021, the share price falls 30%. The investor says, I don't want to take a 30% haircut. I'm going to hold. And then 2022, it, you know, falls 60%. I don't want to take a 60% haircut. I'm going to hold. Now it's 2023. Share price is down 80%. And investors are, they're consumers. They can no longer afford their monthly budget. Back to the front end of this conversation, they're seeking out new credit, can't get it, can't make the auto loan payment, can't make the mortgage payment. So now they need liquidity at any price. And they'll take that 80% haircut because they need whatever's left. They're scraping the barrel. Well, that's my opportunity. It's predatory, but it's capitalism, you know? And I know exactly why they're selling. I know what my competitive advantage is, but I'm clear on that, right? So I can walk forward with confidence and say, I'm sorry for your loss, but it's my gain, you know? And that's how you 100% should play this market. You got to ask that question. You got to have an answer to it. If you don't, it's like you're just a lamb to the slaughter. you know.
Exactly. And it's like your fighter. I like your adversarial fighter analogy. I mean, both from being bullied young and you know, the disagreement when you're making a purchase. Now you're sitting at someone who it's no longer about the 80%. He's lost 80 fights in a row and he's beaten, and you're fresh and you're ready to fight him. He's literally going to concede. So you're dominant, and he has to. It's no longer even about the fight for him. It's forced liquidation time. It is, I'm so sick of this bad news. This has become a monument to my stupidity and my failure. I have to look at it every time I open this portfolio. I can't bear it anymore. Just take it away. It's like a pile of turd on my veranda. Just clean it away, because I can't smell that stank anymore. I just need to pretend it never happened. And that's your opportunity. And that, unfortunately, is many people's predicament. And inadvertently for me, you made a fifth or maybe a sixth or seventh point. I'm not sure if we're counting anymore. But you highlighted how you are unencumbered by debt, and that other party, by force of virtue and need, is a forced seller on account of not managing his finances. And you can't part manage your finances on the investment side and not manage it on the consumption and the indebtedness side. And one of the clear things I say, and we were talking and I threw in that stat about $1 trillion at 21%, clear, all usury extracting debt. I fear for rate spikes for many people. I fear that the danger is actually to the upside. It's part of the way to hollow out the middle classes. Everybody is so debt encumbered in the North Americas, if you don't mind me generalizing in that sense, not purely and solely, but it is probably the most financialized world. UK is not that great, and many other countries too. But you cannot add to a debt pool. You are not living, you're not cutting your clothes according to your cloth. You have to live within your own means. The right budget is the budget that leaves 20% at the end of each month. And that's not, oh, what I get to spend on toys, bikes, and everything else. That's once the entertainment and some of the good life is factored in. And if you're not earning enough, you have to find a way to cut your standard of living until every month you have. And this is the micro habit that you got to compound. That's got to come with a discipline. You have to live probably, compared to your mates, maybe further below your means in the beginning, to later live well beyond what they're capable of living at in the end. So it is the marshmallow test for the kids. The ones that don't eat the marshmallow do get two the next day, do get four the day after. The one that did had their marshmallow and they're done. And you are facing it. And the debt, bringing forward consumption, is as dangerous as leverage is to your portfolio by utilizing credit. You should aspire to have zero debt. I am a happily zero debted for decades man, not on a property, not on a single thing. And I complete on properties now in full cash payments as well, not to be sound like a big deal, but it's because you get to be that point because you didn't do the other. Uh-huh. You've got to compound that. And I know many people say, oh, I've got to have some credits on a home. You just can't get on the ladder. You can't get the quality. And I'm saying to you, fix it and run it down as quick as you can. If you've got to have it, hate it, treat it as essentially a homeless person living in your basement and get to clear him out as quick as you can. And I do understand. We don't know, you know, a smelly homeless person that makes funny noises at night and, you know, he's got some dodgy dealers bringing him some fancy stuff, whatever. You want him out and off the property, because that's what it is. That's what the bank is in your life. And the terms and phraseology, remove the debt. It is the, and I use the 9/11 comparison intentionally, but it is the nanothermite. It is the controlled demolition of your personal finances. And the killer is interest rates. And we don't know how this game ends. But it could get disorderly and disruptive. You will see things you haven't seen in debt markets and in interest rates. If you, for those that recall, old enough to recall, and I may be giving my age away here, the George Soros British pound scenario, there were dealers on the floor. They were now hitting 15% mortgage payments on their homes, saying, who wants to buy my house? Who wants to buy my house? Running up and down, like overextended. Like, you know, they could afford it at 4.5% and now it's gone up 3x, their payment. Yeah. These were guys on big salaries, earning commissions and everything. They just had to get out. Why? Because they had debt in the system. Now imagine an extended George Soros moment that just affected those London property broker dealers that I'm referring to during that period. Imagine an entire nation states like the USA being hit with that on a dollar spike, and the collateral that that would have in the Canadian dollar and many things else. We could have a large, that's a microcosm. The future is in front of you. The seeds of the, you know, the crop of the future is in the seeds of today. And we have seen microcosms of disorderly events in many places. And all that happens is you have the future, the vision of that future within you and in front of you. You just have to have the imagination to potentially see it. And I see problems other people don't see. And I'm not a black-pilled pessimist or a nihilist, as some people sometimes refer to me as. I'm a safety mechanism for how to live that you can be most immune from these external forces that can best preserve you. And that's the stress test we have to try get everyone through to. That's awesome. Jay, any other final bullet points? Because we've had such a good long session with you. Tell me anything else you would like to share.
Well, you know, there's in our series of five, there are a couple more kind of focused on like finding the right people in the sector. They get closer to my zone of focus, which is commodities. But, you know, it's like, that's where I'm looking right now, you know, departing from the sort of principles over to the portfolio, you know, revisiting the fact that it's easier to make assumptions about long-term trends than it is to predict the near-term volatility. I'm in the same camp as you, by the way. You know, I've had Jim Grant on my podcast maybe a month ago. He's like kind of the rate guy, you know, that everybody at Wall Street turns to.
Lovely guy.
He stepped back from this conversation about, like, because, you know, for about 6 months, people discussed the Fed pivot as if it was a certainty. It was like, when is the Fed going to pivot, you know, this quarter or next? And, you know, Jim stepped back and he's like, you got to look at history, because what people are missing is that rates pretty much just went up from 1940 to 1980. They pretty much just went down from 1980 to 2020. These things move in generational cycles, not yearly, right? Yes, there's volatility. Nothing goes up in a straight line. But what you could expect is a multi-decade increase, a secular increase in rates. There might be pauses, maybe pullbacks, all this stuff. Yes, but long-term trend doesn't make him right. Doesn't make him right, but make, you know, he is worth paying attention to. But back to that, like that's how I think about the markets. And, you know, because we're entering this unstable new era, whatever comes after globalization, because we're shaking up the geopolitical chessboard and we're no longer sharing the resources as we used to, I'm very bullish on the commodity sector because of simple fact of scarcity, right? When we're not pooling our resources, they inherently become scarce or unavailable entirely, right? And there's some critical energy metals that we don't know where we're going to get our supply from. China decides to just stop shipping them out, right? And so this, I think, is the decade of commodities, you know, not just the big macro picture. There's two threads there that support this thesis. And the second is that because of the mania in the broad equities market for the last 12 years, you didn't have to look for value. You could just chuck money at the FANG stocks, right? It was a winner's game. You just rode the growth stocks up. They weren't making money and nobody cared. And that's, I mean, those names have continued to decrease in number today. Five companies, as you know, they compose 24% of the market value of the S&P. Five companies, a quarter of the S&P. It's never happened before. It's the literal, like, one falls and they all fall scenario. That's what it is. But this is a rotation. You know, why is that number becoming smaller and smaller? It's because, you know, smart money that I have on my show and you have on yours, and investors like you and I are rotating back to hard assets, right, with speed, and back to raw materials, because in an uncertain world, the value of raw materials goes up. And so, you know, I'm all in on commodities right now. There's a variety of ways to play that market, for the passive conservative investor to the aggressive experienced. But, you know, that's if I think about where do I want to be sitting, what table do I want to be sitting at in the year 2033, 2032, and what decisions am I going to be really happy that I made? I'm quite clear on that. I'm quite clear on that. I don't know what the near-term volatility of the copper price will be, but I know that we don't have nearly enough of it. Same thing with silver, same thing with uranium, right? And frankly, the same thing with gold. Same, you know, and I can go through a handful of commodities in that same fashion. But we're entering a short-term era of scarcity. When I say short-term, I mean like at least a decade. That's kind of how I think about the world, right? Because long-term, I'm bullish on an abundant future. Like I am. But in the near term, we're going through a transition that's going to be really unpredictable. and that's going to...
And you don't just open a mine up in 10 years either. So, you know, you can overshoot that.
That's it. Ross Beaty, one of the most successful mining entrepreneurs the world's ever seen, was on my stage last January. And he came out and he said, look, Jay, we're not short on copper. We've got more than enough. The problem is it's all beneath the surface and takes tens of billions of dollars and decades to get it out. So in the meantime, yes, we have a significant supply issue.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good point. And it's the same with oil. You know, we're not actually, I don't think we've got ever going to get peak oil, but you will have peak $50 oil and $75 oil, but you won't have peak $250 oil. There'll be plenty that will be found at for that price, providing that's what you're prepared to pay. And that also comes with the dollar being a very, very different thing. That's awesome, Jay. That's so much useful information. It's been a great conversation. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. How do people engage with you to hear more about your barbell methodology and how you're taking on this challenge?
So a couple ways, and thanks, Francis. One, you know, I teach a 10-chapter course called The Commodity University for anybody who's looking to understand the basic principles and fundamentals in regards to building a portfolio in the commodity sector. So it's at thecommodityuniversity.com. Really easy to find. I lecture for 10 chapters, but I'm joined by a bunch of friends like, you know, Rick Rule, who comes in and leans in on risk management, five or six other experts that weigh in, you know, how they action these lessons on the street and inside their portfolios. But it starts at the beginning and really the beginning, like what is a commodity? We go through this, you know, a history of commodity trading all the way through to portfolio construction. It's called The Commodity University. It's at thecommodityuniversity.com. And then I publish a Substack every Sunday. It's easy to find. Just look up the Jay Martin letter and I'm easy to find there. Yeah.
Absolutely magnificent. Thank you for your good work towards taking people towards sound principles. Thank you for your principle-based approach as a man of integrity, quite clearly. And amazing guests and name drops in there as well. I personally would love you to do us an introduction to our interest rate observer, Jim Grant, friend. Love to have him on the channel, if you don't mind, dropping him a mail. I consider him the grandfather clock of interest rate observation. He's been there since the time. He's got a cracking sense of humor and is a very entertaining person and very smart.
Yeah, for people who aren't familiar, you know, when Ron Paul was running for the presidency, Jim Grant was who he tapped to be his Fed chair. You know, that's
wow. That would have been, let me tell you, that was the combination that would have sorted America out. Yeah. I mean, that's why I don't have faith in elections. The right people, you know, they selected, not elected, I say, because those guys, I mean, that's the quality in those two individuals that you've just named there. They would win me over and they would actually get me to queue for the first time in 40 years for a voting ballot. They truly would if they made it that far. So that's awesome. Yeah, fabulous. And thanks for giving him airtime, and I'd love to do the same. Yeah, great. So let's just repeat that. TheCommodityUniversity.com and the Substack, Jay Martin. Go look. There it is spelled behind him in luminous J-A-Y Martin. Absolute pleasure having you on. Thanks for making the time. And yeah, look forward to maybe paying a visit to your channel at some time in the future when you want someone to run the charts for you on the big macro technicals.
Yeah, let's do it. I look forward to that, Francis. Appreciate you, man.
All the best. Have a great day ahead, Jay. All the best for now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.